The United States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Michael P. Allen presiding. God bless the United States and this honorable court.
Good afternoon. I'm Judge Allen, and I'm joined by my colleagues, Judge Falvey and Judge Jaquith. We're convened today via video conference to hear argument in the matter of Daniel D. Berry against Dennis McDonough, Secretary of Veterans Affairs, docket number 20-3367. Will counsel, beginning with appellant's counsel, make your appearance, please?
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Kenny Dohakis for Mr. Berry.
Thank you. Secretary's counsel?
May it please the court, Your Honor, Melissa Loomis, representing the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs. With me is Deputy Chief Counsel, Sarah Fusina.
Thank you. Mr. Dohakis, I understand you want to reserve some time for rebuttal.
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes.
And before we proceed, we'll make that happen. Before we proceed, I think Ms. Loomis's video might be lagging. Is that me or is that everybody can see that?
Your Honor, I think you're right. And if we could pause for a moment, Your Honor, we'll get Ms. Loomis to log off and log back on to the conference.
That sounds like an excellent plan.
Maybe you can introduce yourself again, Ms. Loomis, just to confirm that the judges can hear you. We can see you.
Yes, Your Honor. This is Melissa Loomis, representing the Secretary of the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Much better. You're much more in sync now. So, Mr. Dohakis, we'll reserve your time for rebuttal, and you can begin when you'd like.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. On behalf of Mr. Berry, I first want to thank this court for the opportunity to present his appeal today. I see this appeal presenting two primary issues. The first is whether the court has jurisdiction to consider the regulatory interpretation arguments that we presented. And the second is the correct interpretation of certain regulations that tell us how to properly rate Mr. Berry's disabilities. I will begin with the jurisdictional issue and then proceed to the correct interpretation of these three regulations. Issue exhaustion is a principle imposed by courts where some legal authority prohibits an appellant from raising an issue to the court that the agency has not had an opportunity to consider. In Carr, the Supreme Court described it as such: administrative review schemes commonly require parties to give the agency an opportunity to address an issue before seeking judicial review of that question. In veterans benefits cases, the agency's opportunity to address an issue in the first instance is not of a critical issue for several reasons. First, as we explained in our briefing, Congress and the VA in his regulations require the board to liberally construe a claim or appeal with an eye towards, and I'm quoting here, rendering a decision which grants every benefit supported in law. Furthermore, 7104A, 5107B, and 3.155D2, just to name a handful, all require the board to review all lay and medical evidence and apply all applicable laws. Furthermore, 38 CFR 20.202, as it was written in 2017 when Mr. Berry filed his substantive appeal, required that the board will construe such arguments in a liberal manner for purposes of determining whether they raise an issue on appeal. Turning to case law, both...
Mr. Hawkins, could I stop you for one
yes,
second?
Yes, Your Honor.
So I'm sort of thinking of this in a timeline fashion, okay? So all of the points that you're making now about the nature of the system and the regulation and statutes, they were all in existence, if you will, and present in one form or another, not materially different. When the Federal Circuit, for example, rendered its decision in Majit or Majit, however we want to pronounce it, which is really the centerpiece, if you will, of this issue exhaustion. Do you agree with that, basically?
I do, Your Honor.
Okay. So this is not a trick question. It's just, so all of those things, even if I was really excited to say exactly what you've said is precisely what the law should be, I've got Majid out there, which says we have jurisdiction to consider an argument for the first time, but we apply a balancing of interests, if you will. Okay. My question is, in your view, is there something that changed with Carr v. Saul in such a way that the binding nature of the Federal Circuit's decision in Majid that says we apply this balancing and sometimes that will lead to issue exhaustion? Did Carr, in your view, change the existing law or not? Do you understand my question?
I do, Your Honor. And I will start by answering the question, yes, it did. However, I will add that both Sims and the Federal Circuit's later opinion in Scott v. McDonald were the precursor to really what Carr was announcing. And what Carr says is, the way that I interpret Carr is that in non-adversarial proceedings, like Social Security and CAR, and even more so in the Veterans Benefits Scheme, the requirement or the idea of issue exhaustion has less force than they talked about kind of a scale where you go from a wholly non-adversarial, which I would argue is the VA, all the way up to a completely adversarial proceeding where you have counsel on both sides, they're both arguing. And Social Security is somewhere in the middle, probably closer to the VA, but VA is way on the other side. And as this court in the Federal Circuit has acknowledged repeatedly, this is a non-adversarial proceeding. In Sims, which Carr relied upon, although Sims was dealing with a different level of adjudication, and more specifically in Scott v. McDonald, and Robinson, which Scott incorporated into a more helpful ruling. So Scott specifically talks about the idea that the Veterans Court is required to look at every single theory, anything that's reasonably raised, and in particular, In Robinson v. Peek, which was affirmed by the Federal Circuit, the what I think really captures the essence of what the court's, idea that they must review these issues is that it is entirely possible that the record might indicate a theory of entitlement, but that a lay appellant, which we have here, may not be sophisticated enough to recognize the theory. Hence, a theory can be both unknown to the appellant and suggested by the record. And Scott, the Federal
Circuit. Mr. Dohakis, excuse me for interrupting, but so how does the record reasonably raise your principal argument here that reversal is warranted because the board misinterpreted 3.350F3 by not concluding that it provided for additional step increases? It doesn't look like that question was even presented to them.
And it was not, Your Honor. And again, I think that it in one sense, it really requires a much more sophisticated eye than what a lay appellant has, which, of course, we have here. But even if there were an attorney there, Robinson makes clear that this rule applies whether the appellant is represented by an attorney or not. And the issue of 350F3 was reasonably raised because Mr. Berry has a single disability, a rating for loss of use of both legs under 1114M. And then he has, as the regulation describes, multiple combined disability ratings that each independently combine to 50% or more. And when we look at the way that they're broken into body parts, body systems, extremities, et cetera, then we can see that he should have been entitled to higher ratings if the court were to agree with our interpretation of the regulation that more than one half step or intermediate increase is allowed.
But what specific language in F3 supports that assertion?
Well, it's really the regulation as a whole, Your Honor. And as we talked about in our briefing at the very beginning, the regulation is, well, before we get into what the regulation says, I think it's important to start with the statute. And the statute says that in the event that a disability exceed the requirements for any of the rates prescribed in this section, meaning 1114, then the secretary is given authority to allow and give an intermediate rate increase. 3.350 in its entirety interprets and implements 1114. So any rate that's authorized in 3.350 falls within this section, 1114, which means a rate under 350F3 would necessarily be in this section. Specifically to the regulation says, in addition to the statutory rates payable under 1114 L through N and the rate provisions found in 3.350 A through F, which includes F3 and incidentally F4, additional disability or combinations rateable at 50% or more will afford entitlement to the next intermediate rate. And so the way that when you looked at a whole, when you have a rating authorized under F3, where there's an intermediate rate increase, like the VA has done here, and you also have additional single or combination disabilities rated at 50% or more, then that entitles, by using the mandatory language, will afford entitlement to an additional half-step intermediate rate increase.
And your position is that that's the plain meaning of the statute?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
The plain meaning of the regulation, I guess, more specifically.
Correct, Your Honor. Right. The regulation, the statute, as we pointed out in a reply brief, it does give discretion to the secretary, but we read the discretion only to extend to whether or not to allow these intermediate rates. And the language of the regulation, by using this language, will afford entitlement as mandatory. So once the veteran meets the requirement by having a combination of disabilities at 50% or more, then they are entitled to an intermediate rate increase for every when that extra additional disability is in addition to, independent from, and permanent any other rate that's awarded under 3.350 A through F, as the regulation says. And in order to allow for only a single intermediate rate, you would have to read out the language or actually add in the regulation talks about any of the rate in addition to the rates payable between 3.350 A through F. In order to allow only a single increase, you would have to add in there A through F2, because F3 and F4 are both found within F, and it should be inclusive to all rates under F. And so that, to me, is where the very clear and unambiguous reading of the regulation permits this half-step increase. And to circle back to your original question, Your Honor, as to how this reasonably was raised by the record, by applying the unambiguous interpretation of the regulation to Mr. Berry's situation, where he has these catastrophic and severely disabling conditions from his service in Vietnam, it's very clear that he meets the qualifications for this regulation to allow for multiple intermediate rate increases.
It sounds from your explanation that it's an interpretation of a great deal of ambiguity, that the plain specific language of the regulation is, in the vernacular, is clear as mud. No?
I don't believe so. I would disagree, Your Honor. I think it's there's a lot, certainly. But I think when we look at the Supreme Court's guidance in Kaiser in how the courts are to interpret regulations, they make note that sometimes they're very difficult to parse through. But when applying all the conventional and traditional canons of interpretation, the Supreme Court says that, you know, it oftentimes in most cases, a clear reading will emerge. And I think that's what we have here. Even though the language is dense, there's a lot to it. I think when we really assess precisely what the words are and what they mean and how they interact with one another, I think it's unambiguous as opposed to clear as mud, as to borrow your phrase.
Mr. Dehakis?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would your logic about F3 also apply analogously to F4? In other words, if a person had a condition that was rated at 100%, but had another condition that could be rated at 100%, would your argument then under F4 be that that person would get sort of two whole steps?
Yes, Your Honor. I would agree with that statement, Your Honor. And again, it's similar language where you have an additional 100% rating or a total rating, then they will be entitled. Will afford entitlement to the next higher statutory rate or the next higher intermediate rate. Yes, Your Honor.
And to just go back to the issue exhaustion point for a moment, keeping aside the impact of CAR for a moment, whatever that might be, and assuming that issue exhaustion continues to exist in a non-adversarial system such as the VA, how precisely would the board have been able to figure this out? This seems like a pretty novel argument. As you know, I can't recall whether you were counsel or not, but the case was before me once before as a single judge. There was nary a statement about F3. It doesn't appear to me that this issue about F3 was ever flagged for the board. If there's something where you flagged it, or Mr. Barry and his accredited rep flagged it, you know, point that out. But I mean, doesn't this seem a little bit, difficult to fault the board for not going into what is a really complicated issue here about the meaning of this regulation?
Correct, Your Honor. And I was not before the court in the prior case. I came on board after the remand decision. And I will answer that with a couple statements. Number one, going back to Scott was, in my opinion, really supersedes or gives a better explanation to what Majet described. And I would submit that Robinson and Scott are really the controlling case law in issue exhaustion. The issue in Scott was a procedural defect, and the court there said, in procedural defects, it's more appropriate to apply an issue exhaustion type prohibition on court review in the first instance. And so I think that when you look at what kinds of issues the board shouldn't have to, or rather that the appellant should have to or be required to submit to the board, the Federal Circuit indicated that at least a procedural defect should have been. In that case, it was a hearing. There was some issue with the hearing and they didn't raise it before the board. But here, going all the way back to the statute authorizing benefits, 1110 very explicitly requires that the United States will pay for any disability, and I'm adding the word any in there, but any disability resulting from an injury or disease incurred during service. And so we read the statute as a mandatory obligation on the VA's part to pay Mr. Berry for his disabilities. And combine that with 7104A, which requires the VA, again, to apply every law and to also read the entire record, both lay and medical evidence, you see a system where the board has to apply the law as it means. Whether they,
but here's my problem, right? If we were writing on a blank slate, I might go, I might be quite persuaded by that. In fact, if I were on the Supreme Court, I might have joined Justice Thomas's separate opinion about this. The justification you've just laid out, it would seem to me, would apply to almost every situation that didn't involve a pure procedural defect. In other words, it would write out issue exhaustion. And it seems to me it's very difficult to read that into Scott, Robinson, and Majeed. Because it provides a general test, right? So any time one came before the court with a novel statutory argument that had any support in the record, it would seem to me there'd be no way to parse those. They were either all in or not.
Your Honor, I think I would push as far as close to that statement as is possible. I do believe personally, as an appellant's attorney, naturally, that it should be that way. That, again, 1110 requires payment for disability, period. As soon as it's, when you look at that in conjunction with 5110, the effective date is the date entitlement, the facts found, which this court has interpreted to be when it's manifest. But I think maybe to add a little bit of contour to that, Carr is even more applicable to this type of a situation than the hypothetical every single possible argument that we can come up in. In Carr, the issue there was whether the judges, sitting judges, the administrative law judges, needed to be affirmed. There was a constitutional question. And the Supreme Court emphasized that after talking about what, you know, how you don't have it in the pure non-adversarial setting, they emphasize that in cases like in Carr, where it wouldn't do any good, it would be purely futile to raise these issues to the board, then there was even less of a necessity to raise it. And with 3.350F4, our argument is that it's invalid. So clearly that's, it wouldn't do any good. The board has to apply it as it's written.
But Mr. DeHakis, there's no suggestion that it would be futile to have raised the F3 issue here, is there?
I believe there is, Your Honor, because the interpretation of a regulation is to be done by the court, or if the secretary chooses to, in some authoritative official capacity to interpret the regulation. That's not done here. The board's job is to
there's no authoritative interpretation of F3 that goes against your position existent. Is there case law or regulation?
No, Your Honor.
So isn't this exactly the kind of case that would benefit from being raised and of necessity perhaps before the fact finder, the board, rather than for the first time before the Court of Appeals?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, primarily because until this court announces what the regulation means, we can only guess. And what, regardless of what the board's ruling would be, if it even had been raised, the court is the ultimate authority on what the regulation says. And so until the court, or as I mentioned, the secretary in an authoritative announcement tells us what the regulation means, it's futile because the board has no authority to interpret any regulation ever. They are there to apply the law.
No, that's not right at all. That's not right at all. The board interprets regulations every single day. Sometimes they get it wrong, right? But the board can't do is strike a regulation down, right? So if you were correct, for example, that TDIU should count under F4, the board would be powerless to do anything about that. It's bound. But the question about whether F3 allows multiple step increases is something that the board would have addressed and would have been required to address had Mr. Berry said, well, I get a full step under 4, but you don't need to do that because I actually end up getting way more under 3. And then the board would have been able to provide its interpretation of what F3 meant. It might be wrong. Who knows? He might have won before the board and it never would have gotten to us, right? So the board could be wrong about F3, but in a favorable way to Mr. Berry, and we couldn't correct that error, right? So it interprets the regulations every day.
If I can clarify my answer, Your Honor, they do interpret, but their interpretation has no authority. Their own regulations limit the decisions by the board to the particular case before it. And so what we are talking about is a global, so to speak, interpretation that tells everybody in a precedential decision, hopefully in this case, what this regulation means. And so even though, yes, the board may read a regulation and may that board member may in his or her own decision decide this is what I think it means, that meaning has no legal implications outside of that particular veteran. And I understand that I recognize that that's really the system. It goes through appellants to get rulings. But I think in looking to Carr and really, again, looking to Robinson and Scott, there's just no requirement to do so in order to preserve it or to overcome an issue exhaustion within the court, because again, the law, if it requires it, is mandatory. So if the court decides, yes, Your Honor.
Any significance at all to be placed in the fact that the veterans specified that the issue in disagreement was the failure to grant special monthly compensation and under F4?
No, Your Honor.
Before you answer that, Dawn, could you put 5 more minutes on the clock, please? Go ahead, Mr. Jackson.
Thank you, Your Honor. No, Your Honor. And the reason is because the issue that was raised to the board was the proper rating for his disabilities. He pointed specifically to 1114 and the special monthly compensation rates. But even in that case, that was unnecessary. Again, looking at the case law and precedent with TDIU, the veteran never has to mention TDIU. But if the record indicates that there's a potential entitlement to it, then the board was required to discuss it, or at the very least, we can raise it as an issue to the court. And it's the exact same thing. All of these issues fall under 1114, which deals with how to properly rate Mr. Berry's disabilities. And again, going back to as I think Judge Allen mentioned, it's a very complicated and sophisticated type argument that at least one other attorney hadn't thought of. Not to fault him, I know him personally; he's a very fine attorney. But certainly, a non-attorney disabled veteran should not be harmed because he couldn't think of it on his own 5 or 6 years ago when he originally sought his higher rating. All that he knew is that he was more disabled or he thought he was more disabled than what the VA said he was. And he wanted the highest maximum rate. And at one point, in the record, he asked for an O rating. I think that was with his substantive appeal. That was when he got his agent to help out. But again, even then, it's a non-attorney who they recognize he should be rated at the highest level. They just didn't quite understand how to get there. They couldn't find the path because they were not, again, sophisticated enough to get there. And again, going back to what the board says, I just point out in Kaiser, the Supreme Court noted in their decision that the government in oral argument seemed to agree that board members do not speak for the secretary. So any ruling on what the interpretation of the regulation requires would not have mattered to anybody outside of this particular case. Well, I've got about 2 minutes left, so I'm going to save everything that I have for rebuttal unless either of the honors have any other questions for me.
Judge Falvey, do you have any questions?
I do not. Thank you.
Judge Daquith?
No more questions. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Mr. Dahakis. Ms. Loomis, you can begin when you're ready. And you can have 5 extra minutes if you need it. You don't have to take it, but if you need it, you can.
May it please the court, Your Honors. The court should affirm the board's March 16th, 2020 decision that denied entitlement to a rate of special monthly compensation at the rate payable under 38 U.S.C. section 1114N because appellant has failed to show that he is entitled to any additional SMC benefit. The court should find that the plain meaning of 38 CFR section 3.350F3 permits only one intermediate step increase for additional independent disabilities for the following 3 reasons. First, the plain meaning of subsection 3 is wholly consistent with the discretionary authority provided to the secretary under 38 U.S.C. section 1114P. Second, the plain language of subsection F3 that allows for an intermediate step increase for additional single permanent disability or combinations of permanent disabilities rateable at 50% or more clearly contemplates one intermediate step increase as opposed to multiple. Third, subsections F3's limitation to one step increase for all service-connected disabilities is consistent when read with other SMC provisions. First, the plain meaning of subsection F3 is wholly consistent with the discretionary authority provided to the Secretary under 38 U.S.C. section 1114P. Subsection P expressly states in its entirety that in the event the veteran's service-connected disabilities exceed the requirements for any of the rates prescribed in this section, the Secretary may allow the next higher rate or an intermediate rate. Subsection P thus authorizes the Secretary to provide one half or full step increase above the prescribed rates available in section 1114 for a veteran whose service-connected disabilities exceed the requirements of his current assigned SMC rate but do not qualify for the next higher rate. The statutory language through the use of the word the is clear that the next higher or intermediate rate is intended to be singular and therefore an intermediate rate may be applied only one time. Also, through the use of the phrase service-connected disabilities, the statute is clear that the discretion is limited, is inclusive of all service-connected disabilities. Subsection P is thus unambiguous in providing that the discretion granted to the Secretary is limited to granting a singular step increase if inclusive of all service-connected disabilities when those service-connected disabilities exceed the requirements of the current SMC rate. The court should therefore uphold.
Can I ask you a question? Would it, in the Secretary's view, would it be possible to assume your reading of F3 is correct, okay? Would it be possible for somebody to have essentially a 1.5 step increase? In other words, they get a half step under 3 and then a whole step under 4?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. No, that question is not before the court today. I do believe, though, that subsection P is limited to providing a step increase over and above the current assigned rate. So these intermediate and full step increases are intended to be something separate from the requirements which establish entitlement to an SMC rate. So I don't believe that those would be stackable. I think you are limited to either one intermediate or one full step increase, since, again, the discretion is limited to providing a step increase above that which, above the requirements that led to the assigned SMC rate.
Ms. Loomis, what of the language in F3 that provides that additional disabilities will afford entitlement to the next higher intermediate rate, or if already entitled to an intermediate rate, to the next higher statutory rate? Doesn't that clearly contemplate going beyond one step up?
No, Your Honor. So when we're reading the text of subsection F3 as a whole, it does state that in addition to the statutory rates payable under 38 U.S.C. sections L through M and the intermediate or next higher rate provisions outlined above, additional single permanent disabilities or combinations of independent disabilities will afford entitlement to the intermediate rate or next higher rate. So the regulation merely contemplates that a veteran may be assigned a statutory rate at somewhere between L through N, including those half step provisions that are already provided in subsections F1 and F2. So for example, if a claimant was awarded under F1 a SMC rate of L and a half, he would then be entitled to an additional step increase under F3 to the next higher statutory rate. So the language in subsection F3 doesn't necessarily contemplate multiple applications. It merely ensures that the veteran will receive that next higher rate, whether he's at the intermediate rate or statutory rate, based on the current assigned SMC rate.
But F3 doesn't say that. That may be the Secretary's interpretation of the words of F3, but there's nothing in F3 or F anything that says that only one step up is authorized.
Yes, Your Honor. And so it is also important to keep in mind both the text of subsection F3 and its placement within the overall SMC statutory and regulatory scheme. So the Secretary's proposed interpretation does read each word of subsection F3 and then contemplates that within the overall SMC structure. So there is no language in F3 that states that the regulation must be or even that it can be applied multiple times. And additionally, appellant's argument rests on an incomplete recitation of subsection F3, and it's essentially taking words out of context and reading them in isolation. So appellant's argument had ignored that subsection F3 allows for an intermediate step increase for additional single permanent disabilities, as well as combinations of permanent disabilities independently rateable at 50% or more. The plain language of the regulation does not suggest that appellant can receive multiple intermediate steps for each disability rated at 50%. By expressly including that phrase 50% or more, VA explicitly contemplated that a veteran may have multiple disabilities. And so the regulation thus provides one step for any combination of disabilities rated at 50% up to 100%. That's the highest available combined rating. In contrast, F4 provides a full step increase only for an additional single permanent disability independently rateable at 100%. And so thus, any combination of disabilities rated at more than 50% warrants one step increase and no more. And to read the regulation otherwise, render that phrase 50% or more meaningless. Relatedly, F3 also provides an intermediate increase for combinations of service-connected disabilities independently rated at 50% or more. And this language suggests the use of the combined ratings table that's located in 38 U.S.C. Section 4.25, which establishes that the VA must look at all of a veteran's service-connected disabilities in the order of their severity and provide one rating. F3 does not provide an alternative method to rate appellant's disabilities together. And so there's no support for appellant's argument that he can somehow divide his disabilities and treat them independently of one another in order to achieve multiple step increases. So therefore, when we are looking at the regulation of subsection F3, reading each word in its entirety, it's clear that it only permits one intermediate step increase as opposed to multiple step increases.
And it comes down to the regulation, doesn't it? The permissive language in 1114P enables the secretary to promulgate this regulation and make choices, and then the secretary is bound by the choices articulated in the regulation.
Your Honor, it's the secretary's position that subsection F3 does limit the discretion provided to the secretary to provide just one intermediate or full step increase. However, this is an express grant of discretionary authority, and the secretary's interpretation need only be reasonable and not conflict with subsection P. And therefore, in reading the regulation,
what you just said, that the secretary's interpretation, are you asking us to defer in an administrative law way to something about this regulation?
No, Your Honor, just to state that this is an express grant of authority, and the secretary did have discretion to define the circumstances under which a claimant would be entitled to either an intermediate or a full step increase under Section F3 and F4.
Right. I just want to, so you're just restating what your interpretation of the regulation is. I just want to make clear, if we were to determine that the regulation is, quote, genuinely ambiguous, to use Justice Kagan's term, the government is not asking that anything be given deference under Kaiser or Auer, right?
At this point, no, Your Honor, we do assert that the plain meaning...
No, this is the only point. There's no other point, right? It's not like tomorrow you're going to come back and tell me something else. So this is not a difficult, I don't mean to be difficult, but I just want to wrap this up. If we conclude that F3 is ambiguous, genuinely so, the government is not asking that we defer to anything under Auer or Kaiser, correct?
No, Your Honor, I apologize. I misunderstood the question. Yes, the secretary would be asking for deference under Auer if the court.
Now then, okay. But Justice Kagan made clear that not everything an agency just says is subject to the Auer framework, okay? Which means you have to point me to something that you're saying, this is the secretary's interpretation of this regulation. Other than your brief here, can you point me to anything that the secretary has said that interprets F3?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of anything else other than the M21. While this is not binding on either the board or the court, the M21, the internal documentation, does provide for one intermediate or one full step increase. Again, that's not binding. However, that's the only document that I am aware of.
I'm sorry to be so precise about this, but somebody's going to have to write this down. So are you asking us to defer to the M21 under principles of Auer and Kaiser, assuming we find the regulation genuinely ambiguous? Are you asking us to defer to the M21 or not?
No, Your Honor, merely to defer to the interpretation that we have proffered as it represents our consistent approach to interpreting this regulation.
So the only thing then that you would be pointing to if we were going to defer to something in that administrative law technical way are your briefs in this appeal. Do I have that right?
Your Honor, I believe if I could just take one moment to confer with my deputy to answer this question.
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
And Dawn, you can stop the clock for a moment, since we have some five extra minutes here anyways.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor, and I apologize for the interruption.
Go ahead. Go ahead, Ms. Lewis.
Okay. Your Honor, we would be asking the court to defer to our interpretation of subsection 3 as evidenced by the M21, as this does show the VA's consistent approach to implementing subsection F3 as limited to one intermediate step increase, if the court does find that the regulation is genuinely ambiguous.
So then to go back, you now are asking us to, if we find the regulation is ambiguous, genuinely so, you're asking us to employ the our canon, our slash Kaiser, right, A-U-E-R, to say, okay, we have found the regulation genuinely ambiguous, and we will defer to the M21 as long as we consider that to be a reasonable interpretation of F3. Do I have the Secretary's position on that?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct.
Okay, let me ask you a follow-up question then. So the Secretary's position then is that the M21 is not binding on the agency or the board, but so the board isn't then bound to follow it in a way that we can say you're wrong. But then when we get to court, that same document is one that federal judges have to say, well, as long as it's in the ballpark, as long as it's reasonable, we got to defer to it, even though the Secretary in other cases says it's not binding, so don't look at it, right? I don't mean to put words in your mouth, but I just want to make clear that that's the import of what you're asking us to do. Right.
Yes, Your Honor. This is we would be asking the court just for the court to be looking at the VA and how it's consistently applied the regulation in this manner, in consideration of the appellant's novel interpretation of this regulation. And this is just as evidenced by the direction given to our adjudication in the M21.
Yeah, but I'm pressing on this. But the reason the Supreme Court took Kaiser is because the issue of the appropriateness of our deference in administrative law and the constitutional structure was a big deal. And the reason was that courts would not then exercise the authority to, in John Marshall's terms, say what the law is, because what we would be exercising in our deference is, we will say what the law is as long as what the Secretary tells us is reasonable, right? It's sort of shifting to the executive branch. So that's why I wanted to, there's a difference between saying, well, look at the M21, you can see what we've done, and as opposed to look at the M21, you can see what we've done. And as long as you can't say that's unreasonable, you are bound to say that's the interpretation, right? And it seems to me that like the Secretary is arguing for the latter, that we literally give deference to the M21.
Hey, Your Honor, I believe what the Secretary's position here would be is that just looking at the subsection F3 in its entirety and within its place within the SMC structure, as also evidenced by the VA's longstanding approach to interpreting this regulation under F3 of permitting only one intermediate step increase, to looking at these factors all in a totality and then asserting our defense on those grounds, the M21 is merely a document that the VA has that we can show that we've interpreted this regulation in one way consistently. And that's also consistent with the statutory text in F3 and its overall place in the special monthly compensation scheme, and we would be asserting our defense on those grounds.
If there is ambiguity, isn't this where the pro-veterans canon comes in?
Your Honor, it's the Secretary's position that the pro-veteran canon would not apply to this case. As we noted in our brief, the pro-veteran canon is not necessarily appropriate to be applied where there is an otherwise reasonable interpretation of the regulation. And so the Secretary would assert that if the court were to find that there's a genuine ambiguity in subsection F3, there is the reasonable interpretation as proffered by the Secretary of limiting it to one intermediate step increase. This is based on the language of subsection F3 and its overall place in the statutory scheme, and the court would therefore not need to apply the pro-veteran canon here since there is an otherwise reasonable interpretation. The Secretary would also note, as we noted in our brief, that this particular regulation is still veteran friendly. This regulation does provide a step increase for additional service connected disabilities. And this is addition to what was offered at the current assigned special monthly compensation rate. So it does still compensate a veteran both for special monthly compensation and then in consideration that there may be additional service connected disabilities apart from what established entitlement to special monthly compensation. Finally, Your Honors, F3's limitation to one step increase is consistent when read with other USC statutes and regulations. For example, under 38 USC subsection 1114K, as implemented by 38 CFR 3.350A, this specifically permits multiple applications for distinct disabilities, and the exclusion of similar language permitting multiple applications in F3 strongly indicates that no such application is available. And furthermore, in 3.350F4, this provides for a full step increase for a single additional permanent disability, and there would be an inherent contradiction in the regulation if the requirement of a single additional disability evaluated at 100% could be circumvented incrementally by stacking additional 50% disabilities together.
Why do you say that? So, isn't there a universe of disabilities each rated less than 100% that result in a more significant total disability picture than a single disability rated at 100%?
Yes, Your Honor, and that's the way that the Secretary has exercised the discretion under subsection P. So the intermediate step is warranted for any combinations of disabilities rated at 50% or more, up to a 100% combined rating, and F4 has the 100% rating, but that requires a full step disability, one single permanent disability rated at 100%. Your Honor, the Secretary is also prepared to address the order regarding Carr v. Saul. Your Honor, in the court in Carr v. Saul held that it was error to impose an issue exhaustion requirement to constitutional challenges not raised before the Social Security Administration. It is the Secretary's position that Carr does not change current issue exhaustion requirements as relevant to this appeal. One, Carr addressed constitutional issues that are not implicated here. And second, the Federal Circuit has already distinguished the VA statutory scheme from that of the Social Security scheme and has upheld exhaustion requirements in some circumstances. So the Secretary would assert that Carr does not change the doctrine of issue exhaustion as applied to the VA administrative and judicial scheme, and that it would be unnecessary to resort to the analysis in Carr regarding non-adversarial proceedings. And this is due to the federal court's holdings in Scott and Majid, but already to consider that proceedings before the board are non-adversarial in nature. These holdings recognize that the board must give a liberal construction to arguments made before the board, and these cases already supply a balancing test to weigh the agency's interests versus the individual's interests in this non-adversarial proceeding. So while Carr may reinforce the balancing test to favor the appellant where constitutional issues are involved, there would be no reason to apply the balancing test from Carr to the issues on appeal today. And with respect to the claims on appeal, the Secretary would note that Carr does not have an impact. The Secretary noted in our brief that the analysis of Robinson should control. While the Secretary asserts that the board did not commit any error, we do not dispute that the court would be able to exercise its jurisdiction to hear these regulatory challenges, in light of, even though they were not raised to the board, in light of the independent duty to ensure that the laws and regulations are correctly applied. And as it relates to subsection F3, we do note that this was not explicitly raised below and that this was also not reasonably raised by the record. Appellant was already assigned an intermediate rate under subsection F3, and appellant now proposes a novel interpretation of F3 that the board could not have anticipated. So while the board does have a duty to consider all relevant laws and maximize benefits, it does not have to anticipate a regulatory challenge that was not explicitly raised before the board, as the board could not have anticipated this novel interpretation. Unless the court has any further questions, the secretary would request that the court affirm the board's decision.
Judge Falcon.
I have no questions. Thank you.
Judge Jaycraft.
I have no additional questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Loomis. And Mr. Dahakis, you've got your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. I have several points. Hopefully, I have enough time. To start with the Secretary's discretion, I just want to briefly touch on that. The discretion, again, was to create 3.350. It doesn't give discretion to interpret it and implement it in any way that they choose, specifically when it's contrary to the words. Going back to the discussion on Kaiser and deference, although we still hold the position that the regulation is not ambiguous, if ambiguity were to be found, we would urge that there is no deference entitled to the Secretary's interpretation. I would submit that it is entirely inappropriate to allow the M21 to serve as any official or an authoritative interpretation. The M21 changes on a week-to-week basis. The Secretary also stated that they have a longstanding approach to interpreting it this way, but they can misinterpret and misapply a law for a very long time until it gets before the court. And just because they've done it wrong for a very long time doesn't mean that they should be given free rein to do so. Kaiser made very clear that the interpretation must be reasonable. And when we look at the language, and I'm going to point specifically to F4, F4 says, in addition to the statutory rates payable through L through N, in the intermediate next higher provisions outlined above, if a single permanent disability independently rateable at 100% will afford entitlement to the next higher rate. F3 is above F4. And so the Secretary's position that you can't receive a rating under both F3 and F4 should be dispositive as to their reasonableness of their interpretation, and we would urge the court that no deference is entitled. And then, of course, under Kaiser v. McDonough from the Federal Circuit, when there's no deference appropriate or authorized, then the pro-veteran canon is for application. The Secretary mentioned that the regulation is already beneficial to the claimants by giving them a little bit more money. The intermediate rate increases, and therefore no pro-veteran canon should be afforded. I'm paraphrasing a bit there, but I don't think that a regulation that compensates for disability that is present that is caused by Vietnam service, where the veteran was essentially blown up and severely injured for his entire adult life, shouldn't be interpreted in a pro-veteran way. The pro-veteran canon is separate from any regulation that properly compensates a veteran for his disabilities. Turning to Carr, we agree, as we said in Scott, that the Federal Circuit did uphold some issue exhaustion, issue exhaustion in some circumstances. And the Secretary asserts responding to that, to the argument that the Secretary made, the agency's interest is always to grant every benefit supported by the law. That's in the regulation. 3.103A says that they will do that. Bradley and Bowie say that they must pay the special monthly rates when they meet the criteria. This does not limit, and I would say that there is no legal basis for limiting the interpretation of a regulation to one that is announced prior to the board's decision. And this, I think, is the key point with the issue exhaustion, at least in this context. Whatever the law is, that's what it requires. And whether it was interpreted by the courts or the secretary before the board's decision or after, the agency's objective is always to get it right. Their regulation tells them they must pay and grant every benefit supported in law. When the court finds that the law requires more, then the secretary must do so. And limiting a interpretation to a situation before the board's decision is not in keeping with Congress's promise to pay for disability resulting from injury or disease incurred during service. And so in closing, we would ask that this court find that this regulation is unambiguous, that it requires multiple step increases. It also requires a full 100% a full step increase for a single disability and the half step for the 50%. And we ask that you find in Mr. Berry's favor. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dehakis. Unless I see any questions from Judge Val or Judge Jaquith, any? Then in that case, thank you. Both counsel, and the case is submitted for decision.
The court is in recess.